When I was in culinary school 15 years ago, I knew a woman named Stella. She was a pastry chef in the making, and we really didn't know each other that well, but she was smart and thoughtful, and at some point, I went through a really rough patch where I really needed a friend, and she was there, and she showed me true kindness. Well, she graduated not long after, and we fell out of touch, but 8 years later, we found each other on the internet. She'd become that pastry chef, but even more, she'd begun writing a quirky, terrific blog, and eventually got more and more into writing about the science and history of desserts, getting inspired by how classic cookies and cakes and pies and puddings were made in the past, and then reimagined those recipes for the present. And just a few months ago, I was so thrilled to see her first cookbook, Brave Tart, debut on the New York Times bestseller list. So hi, Stella. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk to you about the subtitle of your book, actually. It's Iconic American Desserts. So what makes a dessert iconic American?
I really wanted the book to be a collection of desserts that the majority of us could say played an important role in our childhood. So for me, growing up in Kentucky, sweet potato pie was a tremendously important dessert that we always had around the holidays and that, you know, people just made in general. And I realized pretty quickly that, you know, outside of the South, not a lot of people were eating sweet potato pie. And so that's not iconic. It's a very American dessert, but it's not iconic because there's plenty of Americans who, you know, born and raised here, this is their country, this is the culture that they love, and they've never had that. And so I didn't want the book to be a collection of regional desserts or desserts that were important to some people but not others. I wanted it to be this celebration of all the desserts that connect us together coast to coast.
So how did you decide what qualified?
Maybe it's kind of like that classic quote about porn that you'll know it when you see it. But you kind of have this instinct, right? Like, I mean, something like yellow cake. Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines have ensured that yellow cake is something that all Americans have had a chance to try and love. And we all know what white cake is, and we all know what chocolate chip cookies are. And so on a certain level, some of it's instinctual. But then there's other ones that loom a little bit larger due to pop culture, something like key lime pie. And so that was kind of at least a starting point for determining what it was. And some of it was a little bit crowdsourced on Twitter and just asking people, like, how did your mom make whatever? How did your dad make whatever? And then when there'd be a good response and a lot of feedback, people talking about their memories about these desserts, that I'd know for sure that was a good one. And if, you know, it was like crickets chirping on social media, then I'd be like, okay, this is more of like a regional thing or more of a niche dessert that maybe isn't central enough to American cuisine to want to include.
Sure. But you mentioned chocolate chip cookies, which, you know, a lot of people make from the Toll House recipe on the back of the chocolate chip bag. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned yellow cake before, and you talked about Duncan Hines. And how much of it is about that? How much of it is about our dessert life, our national dessert consciousness is formed by these items that, you know, were popularized by some company that was trying to hawk a product?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of it. That's perhaps the overriding theme of the whole book, is how much marketing and advertising and corporations and back-of-the-box recipes really influenced what we bake, and that someone who's living in Nebraska is making the same type of desserts as someone living in New Hampshire, because they're both getting the same Good Housekeeping magazine that has the same advertisements from the same companies. And it really proved to be a unifying factor. And I think maybe a more cynical person would look at that and think it was, you know, sad or an indictment of our culture. But, you know, we have a really large country, and it's remarkable that we can all identify with these desserts. And so in that way, I think that advertising and marketing really proved to be a positive force, a unifying factor that we can all kind of unite behind in something as simple as a brownie.
Yeah. I want to ask you about red velvet cake. Because before you, I always thought red velvet was just a nice way of saying, you know, kind of bland chocolate cake with tons of red food coloring. So tell us about the real history of red velvet cake.
Yeah, absolutely. So red velvet cake started out from a larger tradition in the Victorian era where there were velvet cakes. And really, this was just like a way to be fancy and at least indicated that the cake had a very soft and velvety crumb. you know, in the 1800s, a coarser textured cake was a little bit more common for the day. And so to have a cake that had this soft, soft, velvety crumb was, you know, very, very appealing. And then there was also simultaneously a devil's cake or devil's food cake. And this was like an intensely chocolate cake that was made with egg yolks rather than whole eggs, and oftentimes coffee or something in there. This was really dark, really bold flavor, really dense and fudgy. And sometime in the early 20th century, I'm kind of personally pinning it around, say, 1911, the two concepts collided, and there was a recipe for a velvet cocoa cake that was published. And this was kind of like a cross between a devil's food cake and a little bit more of a classic concept of a velvet cake. But it was made with cocoa powder in place of chocolate, so that was like the biggest distinction. Mm-hmm. And so then the recipe, as it drifted south, was often executed with buttermilk. And what happened was the acidity of the buttermilk, it doubled down on the acidity in the cake overall. In that time period, most cocoa powder was not only natural, it was also raw. Modern cocoa powders, the beans are roasted. And the combined effect of the acidic buttermilk and the acidic cocoa powder created a sort of density in the texture of the cake, which amplified the velvetiness of it. And simultaneously, the pH of the cake helped some of the color pigments in the raw cocoa powder shine through a little bit more.
Ah.
And so that's why the trick doesn't really work today when people say, like, oh, well, red velvet came from a reaction in the cocoa powder, and you can do this at home. Well, you can't really do it at home unless you get raw cocoa powder, because the type of cocoa you're picking up at the store is going to be a roasted product and not raw.
Yeah. So the red didn't refer to the sort of garish food color red. It was just sort of like a ruddy brown.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a food scientist in the 1930s who commented on it, and she called it a red-brown hue. And she was trying to be very clear about the reaction that was happening, that the pH of this cake batter produces a sort of reddish-brown hue. But that's not really a very sensational story. And so when newspapers were picking this up and talking about the cake, because at the time, the idea of a red devil, which was an alternate name for the velvet cocoa cake, the idea sounds great. It sounds red. But in practice, it really just distinguished the color of this light cocoa cake from the inky blackness of a devil's food cake.
Yeah.
And so this is a little bit more of a Depression era. Like, let's scale back here. Let's use cocoa powder instead of chocolate. Let's use some like old sour milk in the back of the fridge. Like, pulling from these like a little bit more thrifty ingredients. And so it made a less sensational cake. But in order to make a good story out of it, when newspapers would cover it, they definitely played up the red aspect and kind of left off the brown aspect.
And then sooner or later, people wanted it red because they kept hearing that it was going to be red.
Yeah. There's a recipe from like the 1940s, and it had like 4 ounces of red food coloring in there, which is insane. It's, you know, a quarter of a cup of petrochemicals.
Yeah.
That's pretty scary and intense, but it made an outrageously colored cake. And, you know, from there, red velvet really did take off, because obviously that's a very eye-catching thing.
So tell me about your recipe for red velvet cake now that you've done all this research.
With my recipe, I really wanted to get back to the velvetiness that really, you know, defined the original cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to get back to the raw cocoa powder, which is a really cool thing that we can source now on, you know, websites online. It's easy to grab. And so by using raw cocoa powder, the flavor comes out so much more, and it's such a more interesting flavor than just a mild chocolate. And I also use red wine to kind of play up the fruitiness of the raw cocoa powder, and to also kind of like cash in on that chemical reaction that once upon a time made the reaction between raw cocoa powder and buttermilk so impressive. Red wine does something really similar while also playing up those fruity notes.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Stella.
Thanks for having me.
Stella Parks is the author of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts. And you'll find her recipes for red wine velvet cake and for magic key lime pie on our website, splendidtable.org.